Welcome back to the Mindful Edge podcast, where we explore resilience, leadership, and the power of mental health to transform our lives. I'm Dr. P, the leadership coach. I'm one of your hosts today.
And I'm Cecil, the licensed mental health therapist, and I'm another one of your hosts. Today is going to be a special one. Family, listen today. Episode is going to hit on some real life. We've got a guest who wears many hats. She's a DJ, a mom, a proud member of the LGBTQ community, and someone who has turned her personal journey through recovery and grief into leadership and advocacy. I'm going to add, I've been knowing her for 20 plus years as well.
You don't even seem old enough to know nobody that long.
Listen, if y'all could see my gray hair, if you're listening right now and see the gray hair I have, it matches up.
Life stressed you.
Listen, but that's besides the point.
Listen, she is a bomb, and I'm going to tell y'all, she is my crush. So I have been trying to keep myself together. She is the epitome and proof of resilience doesn't look one way. It's eclectic, it's layered, and it's lived. We are honored to welcome my Facebook crush, Stevie Chanel, also known as Stevie Chanel Matlock. Stevie, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited. That intro was crazy.
Listen, we got to introduce you like that because I have known you for 20 plus years. I have watched your journey. I think it's one that is phenomenal. I think it's one that's inspirational. So I think this is going to be a good episode for sure.
Yeah, and I try not to stalk you on social media. I first became aware of you by Cecil would tag you in a lot of things. And I'm like, who is that, man? Her vibe and her aura is just so dope. It just came through my telephone. And so when Cecil said he could get you on here, I'm like, oh my gosh, let me get myself together. Because I'm normally put together. I'm normally calm, cool, collected. But when he said you were going to be here, I'm like, oh my gosh, okay. What am I going to say? I don't even think Ruben has seen me this excited, so he might be a little jealous. when he meets you. But let's get started. Let's talk about your childhood. What it was like growing up. So what was your experience growing up?
Growing up, like I always tell people, looking back, you know, I came from love. Like that's not something that I deny. Mm-hmm. But my father had his own struggles with addiction. Mm-hmm. And my mom was like a single mom. I was the third kid, right above the line for like welfare, so she couldn't get daycare. And it kind of just ended up making sense that eventually my dad brought me from Dayton, Ohio, where I was born, to Toledo, Ohio, to live with his mom. Mm. Time frames, I don't really know. Everybody tell me something different, but I just know my earliest stages of life were with my grandmother. So, and I lived with her until I moved out at the big age of 25.
Oh, wow. That's a blessing to be able to stay until 25.
I was Granny's baby. I was Granny's baby for sure. The last of the Mohicans. I feel like she was like they called her like a den mother, you know. She was one of that was back when she would raise the whole neighborhood.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, it was like that community living. So, very active. She tried to do everything, tap dance, ballet, gymnastics. By the time I was like 9, I had just rejected all of that. I wanted a PlayStation and a basketball and some Jordans. And, I had a good life, man. I really say that all the time. Private school education, ended up at Central, where, you know, kind of built the foundation of some of my strongest relationships, friendships. But the elephant in the room was always the abandonment from my parents. It was just unaddressed. Unaddressed, and I don't even think we were aware that it was there.
Yeah,
you know, I made the decision at like the age of 12 to just stop talking to my mom. I had kind of just had it with the back and forth and the just not feeling important. You know, like I wasn't a priority, and that sucks. you know, to experience as a kid, and you don't have the words. And I just remember it was just one trip to Dayton. My grandmother took me. It was actually Mother's Day weekend. I wanted to go and spend it with my mom. Mm-hmm. And we were there the whole weekend, and I never saw my mom. And after that, I just told my granny, like, I just don't want to come to Dayton to see her anymore.
Oh, wow.
And that kind of changed, like, a lot, right? Me and my mom had, like, a long separation after that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Just the strength to be able to make that decision, right? And your grandmother for supporting you in that decision. I mean, shout out to the grandmas. Like,
shout out to Laura.
Because Cecil's grandma is my auntie, and so, let me tell you, she give you all the tea.
I love that. Yes.
Yeah, and her and my grandma were actually they married brothers. But anyway, that's a whole other conversation. That's a whole nother conversation. But yeah, I tell my cousins all the time, I really was Granny's favorite.
I know I was my grandma's favorite, so I'm not even going, we don't have to worry about that.
I mean, you're the only child.
Only child too. But there's some other cousins as well. Yeah, but I was the favorite.
My granny passed in 2022, and at her funeral, one of my cousins got up and kind of gave some remarks, and he was just like, she only liked two of y'all, and the two, I don't even know if it was me at that moment, right? It was probably my daughter and, like, one of my older cousins, but, yeah, so shout out to the grannies.
I have a grandma's story for Stevie. So me and Stevie been going, been knowing each other for 20-plus years, and Stevie, I had to go pick up Stevie for some reason. I don't even know what it was. She texted me and said, this is when we had to hit the button four times.
Yeah.
Four, three, right? You had to do all that. Stevie, like, do not beep your horn when you pull up to my house.
For real.
Please do not, because my grandma is going to cuss you out. So yes. I pulled up, I got out the car, and I called her and said, I'm outside. She said, good. I'm glad you did not beep that horn.
Yeah, because you wouldn't have never been back.
Grandma would have cussed me out, honestly. Yeah. So
she was
going
to tear him up.
Yeah, so I'm glad I didn't. So of your life lessons, what's the one thing that you take from grandma for your life today?
Man, I quote her so often, but I think the one that sticks out the most currently is that a hard head makes a soft bottom. That's the one that, like, sticks out the most, because I never understood what she meant. She will always say it, and I'm just like, all right, I'm hard headed, you know. you don't understand, right? And I didn't understand until, you know, we'll get to that part of my story, but there was just this moment where I'm just like, oh, this is what she meant. It's just hearing it for all those years. So I think that's one that, like, I carry with me. I repeat to, you know, my clients and my daughter. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just we can choose to do whatever we want. The consequences.
Ooh, those consequences.
That's something totally different. Yeah.
That's like, a perfect segue to what we're about to ask.
Yeah. Listen, and I was one of those children. I always wanted to see how soft my bottom could get.
All the time. So, but see, I didn't get no whooping, so I'm good.
I see that for you, actually. Knowing you like I know you, I definitely feel like you ain't getting no whooping.
Nope, I ran away from one and ran under the table one time. So, so with the word recovery, it means something different for everyone who's walked it. For you, what does that journey look like for you?
To recover to me means to go back and get what was lost. Wow. Right? That's what recovery means to me, to get back what was lost. And the thing that was lost was myself. And that's what this journey is today, is just a continual process of finding me. You know, and how to navigate life as this person. Because I knew how to navigate the toxic stuff. Well, I don't know if I knew.
Right.
But that's what I did. Okay. You know, that's what I was comfortable with. That's what I was familiar with. So to recover to me means to go, you know, go find myself.
Wow. I wasn't expecting that. See, that's why she my crush. I mean, not too many people can stun me.
I love that. I love that.
Yeah.
Stumped you. I seen your face when I said it.
Along with that, going back to find what was lost, what was a turning point that shifted you from survival toxic to stepping into basically self-leadership and recovering what was lost?
So I never had like a super healthy relationship with alcohol. Mm-hmm. And obviously I shared that I'm like the predisposed generation. I'm the third generation also.
Okay.
And when I came out as far as like gay, I had like my daughter was two, blew my life up then. Mm-hmm. But now this time I blow it up, and this time it's without support of my family. Kind of felt estranged, right? A lot of judgment. I feel like I'm the first only openly gay person in my family. So that's when my relationship completely changed, and it became more of like a coping skill. And you can kind of just fast forward, right? You know how that story goes. Lost jobs, wrecked cars, the evictions, mm-hmm. terrible nights, wake up, don't know where I am, mm-hmm. you know, all of that. And it got to the point where I had walked away from a toxic relationship and was dating somebody completely different, and my behaviors didn't change. Mm. And it blew me, like, because I'm not that person. Yeah. That was her, right? Yeah. But it was like, oh, no, it's you. And eventually, I guess to say, like, I drank myself into a bipolar alcohol-induced episode. And I just was out of my mind. And I remember being so terrified, like, did I just lose it all? Like, I knew that I was out of my mind. It was just this out-of-body experience. And I called my aunt, who is probably the one who gives me the toughest love of them all.
Yeah, there's always one.
Oh, she don't play. She don't play. But she was also, like, 17 when I moved to Toledo, so I was, like, her little sister.
Okay.
So, you know, she's just been able to, you know, watch my journey. And I didn't know where to go get help, how to go get help. We called a number. They was trying to send me to Florida. My granny was still in her right mind at that time, and my dad and my mom, everybody was talking behind my back. I'm just out of my mind talking to my aunt saying I want to go get help. Right. And she's doing all everything else. But nobody in my family thought that Florida was a good idea. They was like, no, you're going to get off of this plane and go completely left. absolutely not. So, you know, we ended up finding resources here. I detoxed here, did treatment here. And I never committed to, like, staying sober forever, you know? And I think that's what's gotten me to be a little over 3 years sober now, because I didn't know. I just was like, I just need something different. You know, I needed something different. And, you know, just shout out to my clinical team. I needed some clinical interventions, dog. Like, to say to... I needed a lot of those, you know? And then this version of myself just kind of started to emerge. But I think even C would say that I was probably always like a natural leader, mm-hmm. right? I just kind of, I lost my way, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, Stevie was one who was influencer in high school.
I could tell.
So my senior year, Stevie was the reason I wore black horses to school, right? We were supposed to wear dress shoes. And so Stevie had found a way to wear black Air Force Ones that look like dress shoes. And I was like, how'd you get that off? And she's like, I've been wearing them since the first day of school. Get you some black horses, put them on. Yeah. Then when energy drinks were coming big into like early 2000s, Stevie would be the first person, the only person I knew that was drinking Ripple. And I'd be like, what is that? She'd be like, it's my energy drink to keep me up. And I'd be like, I'm gonna try one. I should have never tried it.
Definitely.
Because that was the worst. But she was influencing others during our senior year.
Yeah.
I knew Stevie was always around, and she probably was from freshman year on to senior year. Mm-hmm. However, my senior year, me and her got really, 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 really mm-hmm. close.
Yeah.
So besides me being along with your journey, who else was around when you were recovering as well?
I was isolated. I had to get away from everything and everybody. I was alone at Team Recovery is where I did my treatment. And it was just me and them, sober living. I would go to clinicals, and I would go to the sober house. And that's what my life consisted of for 8 months.
Oh, wow.
8 months. No, I don't even think anybody. Well, let me take that back. My bowling team.
You bowl?
Yes, I bowl. And the reason why they're much more influential than, they're like bowling team, right? Yeah. Like, yeah, okay. Yeah. These people saw me at my absolute worst. They didn't even want me to come back. When they found out that I was in treatment, you know, trying to like get myself together, they're like, nah, just sit the season out, you know, we'll just, I'm like, y'all not replacing me, bro. Like, absolutely, absolutely not. But it's such a toxic environment. It can be, especially for me, it was.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And so they like, nah, just do this. And I remember talking to my facilitators, my therapist, my sponsor. Everybody was like, absolutely not, except for my therapist. Because the conversation with me and him was, I told him, if you can't help, if this process can't help me be okay around alcohol, then I don't want to do it.
Oh, wow.
If I'm going to be squeamish, running from red cups, you know, I don't want to do it.
Yeah, it's that red cup.
It's that red cup.
Yep.
Yep. Every time, it's always something in the red cup. Yep. Yeah. That's why you don't see me with them, because I don't even need people to even get that in their head that it's something else.
Exactly. Yes.
You know. So, so going back, my bowling team was like that safe exposure. Okay. They weren't gonna let me drink, and then I would spend 3-4 hours with them, go back to sober living after, and then have to drop the next morning. So it was like a crazy accountability. But I really feel like that was influential in me being able to do what it is that I do today, which is DJ around alcohol a lot, a whole lot. So like my bowling team was very supportive. You know, how many days you got, and you know, just they just very supportive environment considering. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I would be this without like their help.
So in a way, it was like exposure therapy.
It was exposure therapy.
What's exposure
therapy? So for the listeners, I was getting ready to explain exposure therapy, right?
You got to explain it. Say it,
right? So exposure therapy is putting you in places that might have increased your worry, your anxiety, or might have given you a way to increase relapse, right? So if I expose you to a bar one time and we talk and you're around it and you get yourself some water, it's harm reduction. We don't want you to go drink, but we want you to be able to be exposed to an environment that still may have triggered you. Mm-hmm. If you're a person that has a fear of bridges, we're not going to drive over the bridge first. We're going to go to the bridge and let you look at it.
And that's why I won't go to that one walking group, because I see that the bridge. Walk over a bridge.
Right. So exposure therapy is a bridge, right? So I take you to the bridge. What does the bridge make you feel like? How do you think about the bridge? Okay, let's walk on the bridge now. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, we're going to stay here about 5 or 10 minutes. Okay, come off the bridge. Now we're going to walk on for about 20 minutes. Exposure therapy is exposing you to a stimuli or an environment that might have overwhelmed you or triggered you. And now we reduce it.
And see, that's why you the therapist. Because
Now for my recovering peers, this by no means mean go to the trap house.
No.
This is not that type of...
Don't go to the trap.
Don't go to the trap, right? Don't go to the trap. But alcohol is something you can't avoid.
Correct.
Yeah. It's,
you know, so it was one of those things that I really felt strongly about learning to navigate. Mm-hmm. So.
No, I mean, that says a lot. And I'm glad that you mentioned that, because it's so acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Having had a stepdad that had addiction issues, and his addiction was, you know, at the time it was crack cocaine, right? And that has a stigma associated with it, right? And this was the era when you had the song "Your Mama's on Crack Rock."
Mm-hmm.
It was not a good time for your dad to have these sort of addiction issues. But alcohol has that social acceptability, which I could see why the exposure therapy may help if you're at that place in your recovery, because it's every, I mean, you can't go to a restaurant without a cocktail menu.
Here's also a caveat. Some people can't do exposure therapy.
I was about to say,
so I wanted to make sure I had to say that as well, so that there are people who don't think that I can put myself in those environments and still respond like Stevie responds.
No.
Because everybody can't do that.
Okay.
So, yes, there has to be some level of understanding and discipline from the therapist as well.
Mm-hmm. Which is why when you're going through recovery, you can't do it on your own.
Absolutely.
You need a team of experts to be able to say you can, you know.
Absolutely. Yes, individualized, 1,000%. Absolutely. Yes.
It's a very, every person who should get sober, we all have like our own hook.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing that that like keeps us sober. It'll always be different for everybody. For me, it's like music and, you know, just the vast communities that I'm a part of now. But it's a very individualized process. And where I got sober, it was very mental health centered. And then also recovering.
Yeah.
So there's like, they taught me how to manage my mental health, which would directly support my ability to stay sober. Because it's like a cycle. They play off of each other. If my mental health is bad, then it could put my recovery at risk.
Correct.
And if I'm not staying sober, then I'm having mental health flare up. So, you know, it's just, so that's how they taught me to manage. And I feel like that's what I still do.
Yeah. I like that. I never heard it in that way, which helps me understand from a non-therapist point of view is, yeah, you have to have a team. You can't just do cold turkey, may only last so long.
Mm-hmm.
But then when crisis, but I tell my leaders, right? Mm-hmm. You don't know what you're made of until crisis hits.
I always say that as a facilitator is that you have no idea if you're done until it's battle tested, until life throws you back on the fire. And now I have to use the coping skills. I have to reach out to support. Mm-hmm. I have to go to the meeting. You know, I have to do these things or I won't stay sober, you know. And the interesting part of my journey is that I got battle tested at about 3.5 months.
Wow. That's still fresh.
Oh, way too fresh. Way too fresh. So that nice lady that I was telling you about that raised me, she passed away, and I was like 102 days sober.
Oh my goodness.
Yep. And that threw me into probably one of the darkest moments of my life. Mm-hmm. And I had to navigate it. I didn't have to. Mm-hmm. I chose to. I had to navigate it sober. That was just tough. That was tough. You know, I had no coping skills. All I was doing at the time was going to group and going to the gym because we had a gym in the treatment facility. And then going, I guess you could, Cecil knows, but the gym is still one of my biggest coping skills.
Is. I know, but I stalk you on
that. You see my gym videos, you know? Yeah. So it just, you know, you don't know until crisis happens.
Yeah.
You know, as far as recovery. And I had got presented with the theme of like, no matter what. If I never become a full-time mother again, will I stay sober no matter what? Right? If I don't get the dream job, will I stay sober no matter what? Mm. If I can't go back and fix this relationship, am I willing to do this no matter what? Yeah, shout out to my facilitator because she did her biggest one. She did her big one with me because I related to her so much. So it's like, even though my grandmother, she saw me sober, but will not be here to experience the rest of this journey, am I willing to do this no matter what?
That was one of the biggest moments for me that I was worried about Stevie.
Yeah.
And I remember reaching out to her and telling her, like, I'm worried about you.
Yeah.
Because that grief while recovering can spiral you to a wholly different place.
And it's crazy because I remember somebody on my care team said, in hindsight, it was like maybe 6 months later, I think it was time for me to complete the program. She said, I was so worried. Mm-hmm. She said, but I wasn't worried about you drinking. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering when you were going to pick your head back up. Because it stayed down for a very long time. Yep. Oh, wow. So that was tough, you know.
Yeah.
Grief is hard for everybody. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's any way to handle grief in like a healthy way. It's just like your way.
Mm-hmm.
But we knew for sure one thing that Stevie couldn't do was go to the liquor store. Right? So I was like, it's just like, so what? You know, and then I remember like that week, family's in town, and I thank God for my dad and his recovery because he was essential because I think we were the only two sober people.
Wow.
You know, okay. This is,
They bring out that red cup quick.
Yeah. Cups. And my family would drink straight out the bottle, you know, like me and my cousins, too. You know, so no judgment. Because I love them. And we had a time until my time was over. So, and it was crazy that even in those moments, right? Like they're passing and they were thoughtful, but again, all of us are dealing with grief. Correct. So how much considering can you do exactly. when my grandmother was such a staple? She was the matriarch, you know? Mm-hmm. So I never got offended or anything. And I just remember one night we were like riding around and we had went to like somebody's house and then somebody else's house. And then I just was kind of like, you know, can y'all take me back to sober living? Because I was through. And that's when I knew. Not felt like I had it, right? But felt like the sober living had become a safe place.
Gotcha.
When I, you know, even in the midst of all of that, I was like, oh, I'm ready to go. Can somebody drop me off, please?
Take me back.
And that's when I knew that some stuff was clicking.
Yeah.
Right? Some stuff was clicking.
It was a safe place.
Yeah.
So now that you've talked about your grief as pain, how has it become your strength and your wisdom?
I think it helps me respond to life differently. You know, when you lose somebody so important, I remember my therapist saying there's two ways that people handle grief. They either embody that person or they die with them. And I'll never forget that. I was in treatment. It was my treatment therapist. And I just, so it was like, he was like, you can carry her with you. And I feel like I do. I say a lot of her lines. I'm slightly unhinged like her. You know, don't hold nobody up. So, you know, I think in memory of it, it was like empowering, you know, to instill in my daughter and people that I encounter the same type of love, even though it was a twisted little love, it was still love. It was love just how she knew it. She was born in like 1934, you know? So times was,
it was different,
you know? And that's the thing that I learned, right? To like give people grace.
Yeah.
You know, you gotta give them grace. They do what they think is the right thing.
Yeah.
Even though I'm still in therapy, I'm packing half of it, you know? So I just feel like I keep her with me. And even though I still have, I mean, grief is a thing that'll hit you like a ton of bricks.
Oh my God, it comes out of nowhere.
My favorite thing I said in the first podcast we did, the first one was it's a silent best friend.
Yes, because it just comes and goes as it wants to, you know? And so just kind of allowing myself to feel what I need to feel. Like, I don't run from my emotions today, and I think that's probably one of the best things that, like, recovery and the therapeutic process gave me. I remember I used to go to the cemetery and just cry and then get up and leave, and I remember I was asked my mentor, I was like, is this normal? Mm-hmm. She said, that's probably the healthiest
it is
I've ever seen somebody grieve. She said, you identify that you miss her, you go have a conversation, you cry it out, you wipe your tears, you get up, and you go on with the rest of your day. And yeah, so I just keep her with me. You know, she doesn't go anywhere. Yeah. But grief is just, it's different, and we rolling right on into, right, this October, this day.
Oh, yeah, holiday season.
Holiday season.
And like she also passed 2 days before Thanksgiving, man.
No, grief, I'm listening to you, and you're helping me in my own grief. Mm. You know, I buried a cousin 2 weeks ago, but it was in therapy that grief triggered the grief that I never dealt with when my brother/cousin passed away. Uh-huh. And it's been, 17, 18 years. Uh-huh. And the family's like, oh, we're going to go to the cemetery. You know, they're in a group chat. We're going to go to the cemetery. We're going to do this. And I remember saying, I don't even know where it is. Because I haven't been since we buried him. And then what does that look like, right? So I'm 49. I was in my 30s when that happened and had to process that. Mm-hmm. But it was Cecil's grandma, my auntie, because I picked her up for the funeral. And boy, when they give you the tea and they say it was the best thing, because it was her wisdom, those nuggets that helped me deal with it in that moment. So yeah, it comes in circles, right?
It does. And the one thing about grief that I learned when I went to grief counseling myself was, if it doesn't harm you or hurt you, continue to do it.
Yes.
right? Because sometimes I think when we're in a grief season, we're in the holiday season, we want to avoid, mm-hmm. we want to isolate, we want to remove,
yeah.
versus like, let's just be around people and socialize. Mm-hmm. If I only got an hour, I got an hour in me. If I only got 10 minutes, I only got 10 minutes in me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remove myself. But if it's not harming or hurting you, continue to do it.
Okay, so Stevie, I know we... Do you like sweet potato pie?
Yes.
I make the best sweet potato pie.
I'll see you Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I make you a sweet potato pie.
Yes.
I make the best yes. sweet potato pie ever. So
that's one of those things right now as a recovering alcoholic, I have an insane sweet tooth. And it's okay, not
baby,
like Skittles. It's not like Skittles. It's like
baked goods. No.
Baked.
I bake like an old lady.
Yep.
Okay, so we got. I'm gonna make a note.
Yeah, yes, make a note. Make a note.
And I make my own crust.
Oh,
I got one with my own crust, or do you want a Chessman cookie crust?
Ooh, wow.
Okay.
Okay.
Maybe my name should be Stevie.
I love this. I love this so much.
So now that you're on the other side of the fence now, mm-hmm. And you're walking along your recovery journey, but you're also helping others with their substance use challenges. What does that work look like for you day to day, Monday through Friday?
Whew. That's a job. That is a job. Just think about you at like your most unhinged moments, right? And then put 170 of them in the same community.
What? That yeah. many people you work with?
Well, I don't directly, but mm-hmm. that's like
the
population. Being for me, my style as a facilitator is very direct. Mm-hmm. Very, very direct. Because the reality is that I don't have time, we don't have time, you don't have time for me to beat around the bush and try to get you to figure this thing out because mm-hmm. the drugs that are out there now are...
Oh my gosh.
It's nothing nice about them.
Yeah.
You know, and they it's at a rapid rate. And so I need you to really figure out how to wrap your head around the fact that you are powerless over this. Mm-hmm. You are not a recreational user.
Yeah. Yeah, no such thing.
Yeah.
You have officially crossed over, you know, and there needs to be some big changes. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoy the work. I think I've learned so much just about humans. Mm-hmm. I've had to learn how to deal with trauma, mm-hmm. People with persistent, severe mental health issues, and then just the ones that are like me who are just knuckleheads. And those yeah. are my favorite. The knuckleheads mm-hmm. are my favorites because I know they can get it, mm-hmm. you know, and I love when I see them get it. And I feel like this summer just been like a different summer for me, but I was just kind of questioning, like, why am I, like, is this what I'm supposed to be doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's one of those jobs. It's a emotionally taxing.
Yeah.
You know, you facilitate somebody, you look up, and 2 weeks later, they make an RIP post on Facebook, and it's just like,
yeah.
You know, like, I don't know how much my little heart can take. And then I remember that I've seen people get their kids back. I've seen people go to school.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen people, you know, just turn their entire lives around. And so, you know, while I can mourn and grieve the ones who don't make it, I still show up for the ones who absolutely will.
Yeah. Dope. That's dope.
That's dope. So how do you balance guiding people through it but still honoring their process? And you've kind of touched on it, but is there... something, or what is the something that helps you balance that?
I think one thing I've learned is that we all have our own answers.
Mm.
We just have to have help figuring out how to get there. You know, I think I want my kids back, or, you know, I want to rebuild with my family, but we never identify the barriers. And so it's just about identifying those, and when they can identify those, then they're empowered to work through them on their own sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, what is it? Is it trauma? Mm-hmm. You know, what is it? Is it shame?
Mm-hmm.
What is it? And when so I feel like my job is to help them identify the barrier.
Okay.
And then it's like their choice how they go about navigating.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that keeps them, you know, helps them move forward. Like I said, because you don't want people to be over-reliant on clinical care teams, because that can happen, especially in, like, I know in my job it can. You can kind of form that little codependent little, you know, and so you kind of want to make sure we continue to empower them to do these things, but just take the suggestions. And so it's a very delicate balance, I feel like.
So it sounds like you're kind of leading the leadership on, I'm walking with you.
Yes, I'm walking with you. Okay. But one of the OG guys in AA says, I'll meet you where you are. I'm not staying where you are.
Nice.
Mm. Right? I will meet you right where you at, but I'm not staying there. So if you want to hold my hand and we navigate this together, I'm all for it. But if you think I'm about to drag you, put you on my back, any of that, that's not it. Like, I always tell them, we got this thing where I tell them, you know, most people, when we're struggling, you want people to go down, come down in a hole and get you out.
Mm-hmm.
I said, but survival mode teaches me that these people will climb out on my back and leave me down there. Mm-hmm. So this is what I tell them. I said, I got a rope and a flashlight.
You better pull up.
You better figure it out. I'm right here, though. I'm going to tell you, you know, put your hand over there. You know, put your foot over here, right? I can help you. Mm-hmm. But I'm not coming down there. And I think that's been, like, sticking with me lately, because I've been struggling with, like, my own emotional boundaries with people. Okay. So, you know, it's one of those things, like, am I willing to sit in darkness? Am I not? You know, what does that look like? So it's like, I do have a flashlight, though.
Yeah.
And I can help you get out of that. Okay? You just got to listen to some things.
Okay. Yeah.
So we'll segue to the joy and the resilience of you. So you're a mom, you're a DJ. Cecil told me that you used to be a rapper. So you're this creative soul. Mm-hmm. How does those creative parts of you, how does it fuel your resilience?
I think that was my hook. I think that was my hook, getting back to creating, whether it's creating my own, like, looks, what I wear.
No, because you have a whole vibe.
You know, thank you. I love that. Thank you.
Cecil's looking like, calm down, Patrice.
Okay. I'm like, I'm still no sweet potato pie, so I'm
he's jealous. I'll share. Yeah, so, like, and then now, you know, like, when I started DJing again, it was like the mashup. So it's like I get to kind of just invite people in, you know. Creatives, I feel like we always give a part of our soul.
Yeah.
And so I think just being able to share that with people and to be able to be unapologetic for the first time. I don't care about judgment. Mm-hmm. I don't care about their feedback. You know, I just literally just do it to share. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of one of those things that keeps me just, like, moving forward. You know, because who knows where this thing can go? Yeah. I always say I'm taking it to the moon.
Can I ask her a question?
Go ahead and ask her a question.
Okay. So you know how when y'all be, you and Cecil, y'all take y'all pictures and he be behind your DJ booth?
Yeah.
Like, I want to come one day. Can I come one day? And of course, okay, your partner, she has to approve. And then I'm going to have to ask Ruben if I could go.
We got to get some permissions.
Okay, some permissions. Okay.
Sure.
So you want to be the DJ booth?
I do.
You want to hang out with the DJ?
I do.
Come on.
Yes.
Come on. Okay. That's like everybody's favorite.
And I'll wear, like, a shirt that says Stevie Fangirl, like, whatever. Like, I'm, like, the fangirl president, whatever. I'll even carry. I don't know if they have crates. Do they?
No, crates. You don't have to carry. You can't carry.
Oh, that's telling me how old I am.
Yeah.
Okay.
We don't got to do none of that no more. No. It's all digital.
The crates are digital.
It's all in my computer.
So I just got to carry my laptop as my crate now.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So I'm okay.
Yeah. You're right. From a different era.
I am. Yep. I'm from the
OG era.
OG. I'm OG all day.
Music is therapy for a lot of us, myself included. How does music connect you to healing and joy?
Oh, man, it's the words. It's the words when I can't speak. I'm not always a vocal human. I'm not a vocal human.
Let me write that
but
down.
You'll know if you come to them sets and you start to hear me enough, you'll know. You'll be like, yeah, she crashing out back there. You know, like, you know, like it's so powerful, too. As a DJ, you get to see, you know, I kind of dictate the energy of the mm-hmm. night. They don't yeah. dictate it all the time. A mm-hmm. lot of times that's us. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, what do I want? Do I want you super flirty? And, mm-hmm. you know, do I want it to be super toxic? Do I, you know, do you want to take them to bed? Or, you know, you got the other songs, yep. right? The trap music. The yeah. Do I want y'all to get rowdy?
And
so,
I'm a Chicago stepper.
Okay.
So you
so
get
that's
the
a vibe. That's a vibe.
Yeah, I'm stepping on.
Yeah, that's I love steppers. That's mm-hmm. such a vibe. So, yeah, it's like sometimes in my own sets, like I just share my own emotions, mm-hmm. yeah. you know, and then you kind of look around the room and you realize we all going through something, you know? So, yeah, that I think that's like the most therapeutic part for me uh-huh. is just being able to share my own stuff without having to like talk,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
you know, get tired of talking. I'm a facilitator and, you know, and then also being able to watch like even people be down and watch them become uplifted, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. just because of the music. Mm-hmm. I think that's powerful.
Yeah. It's so dope watching Stevie's journey because she be messaging me like how you was calling me, how you made the post and said if Cecil don't have a social battery, if I don't have a DJ battery, it might be because of Stevie. Cause she gonna be like, bro, what you think about this? So it's very similar.
I want to be in on the group chat. Okay, Cecil is like, P, what is going on today?
You already have that VIP access on the phone, so you want to be in the group chat and the phone?
Yes. Okay. So, Stevie, as a member of the LGBTQ community, and I must say, I have three moms. So, mm-hmm. I have my mom that raised me, and then I have my two moms. I call them my other mothers. They have been in my life over, I don't know, 30 years now, but I met them in graduate school. And so I always say, don't mess with Mama Deer and Pa Deer.
Mm-hmm.
How has your identity being a part of this community, and you mentioned coming out, how has your identity shaped your sense of belonging and the way you lead your life?
You know, you don't...
being a part of that, you got me.
You just have no idea how it's going to be received. It's one of those things, right? People can make jokes or be seemingly in support and you just have no idea. And I know a big part of like my healing journey has been to like go grab 25-year-old Stevie mm-hmm. and let her know that she does belong, right? And you know, people do want me around because for a while I didn't think so. I also don't make being gay my entire personality.
Mm-hmm.
Just like I don't make being a DJ, just like I don't make being a sober person.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not overbearing or obnoxious, right? If you know me, you'll know that I have a girlfriend. You know, but I'm not just throwing everything at everybody's face, right? Like I've learned to respect people's opinions even when I don't agree.
Yeah.
Like, they have a right to think that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why they think that.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess for me, being a part of other communities.
Yeah.
Like, not just, everything that I do isn't, like, gay-centered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Run Club and, you know, all of these different, my DJ homies. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, just being able to be accepted in those spaces, I feel like helped me feel like I belonged.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here at the Mindful Edge, we talk about resilience, we talk about leadership, and we talk about mental health as tools for living fully. In your own words, what does resilience mean to you?
They don't like it when you bounce back.
Ooh, listen.
They listen, don't like it.
Listen.
They don't like it when you bounce back.
That's one of my workouts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's been my theme song this whole journey, mm-hmm. you know. And I think, like, slow and smooth is okay.
Okay.
Sometimes we want to get it all back.
Yeah.
I got to prove to them, you know, whatever they thought not true. And so we try to jump through hoops and jump through hurdles, but it's your own journey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, own pace, own race.
Yeah.
So I just, in this one, while I'm grateful, I know that I'm still building the foundation. Most mm-hmm. people would say that I took off already, and I'm like, you have no idea.
Right.
You know, you have no idea what I plan on doing. Yeah. But yeah. I had to build a solid foundation. So, yeah, man, just bounce back.
Okay.
You know, take the punches, right? Take the knockdowns, you know, go back to the corner, regroup, mm-hmm. you know, and come back out swinging.
Yeah. And if someone is listening and they're right in the middle of recovery or grief or struggling with their identity, what's one practice or one piece of wisdom that you would want them to carry forward to help them out of their situation?
Just keep going.
Keep going.
Just keep going. Yeah. You'll stumble across the right people who will be able to help you, you know, at the right time. I believe that when a student is ready, the teacher appears.
Ooh.
So I you know, you keep going. If you wanna get in shape, start going to the gym. Like you gotta start the process. You'll find the help. When you start the process. Like, I didn't find sober people. I had to start the process. And then, mm-hmm. oh, look, there's sober people. You know, so just keep going. Just keep going.
Okay.
I like that.
So before we let you go, we have what we call these Mindful Edge rapid fire questions.
Okay. Oh, man.
So, Cecil, you go first.
I'm gonna go first. All right. So I know you said Bounce Back was one song, but what's another song that lifts your spirit?
Keep Your Head Up, Tupac.
Oh, I like that.
Okay. What's a resilience mantra you live by?
I can do hard things effortlessly.
That's a t-shirt.
One thing you've learned from being a mom that influences your leadership?
People not going to listen. Tell them anyway.
That's for all parents.
Must be a teenager. Oh, yeah. She's not, you know.
So, Stevie, I thank you for showing up today and telling us your story, giving us your honesty, giving us your energy. Getting a sweet potato pie. You have given us a blueprint for what resilience looks like.
Stevie, thank you. I'm going to get Cecil a sweet potato pie too. I'm not going to live that down.
I'm going to tell y'all on the next episode if she did or not.
Thank you, Stevie, for being here. And to our listeners, tell us or tell them, where can they follow you? How can they get in touch with Stevie Chanel?
So, on all social media platforms, it's Stevie_Chanel. And then also the Team Recovery, theteamrecovery.org. You know, if anybody is just in need of help, yeah. right, they're there to assist. We are there to assist.
Till the next time, guys, stay mindful, stay strong, and stay on edge.
If you have any questions or you want to know more about us, go to wgte.org/mindfuledge. I love y'all double time. And once again, we always have to thank the dopest producer, Chris Pfeiffer, and the WGTE team. We'll see you guys. Well, not we won't see you. We'll talk to you guys later.
Talk to you guys soon.
Love y'all double time.
WGTE. Voices around us.